Welcome to the fire.
Welcome to the fire, boys. My name is Parker McDonald.
And I'm Walter Lee, and we'll be your hosts on this episode of the Southern Collective Hunting Podcast. If you're a new hunter trying to learn the basics,
or you're a veteran woodsman just trying to get through your workday, there's always a place at our campfire for you.
Speaking of the fire, we would love it if you guys would join our growing Patreon community and be a part of the best and only digital deer camp south of the Mason-Dixon line.
Come on. If you'd like to learn more, click on the link in the show notes. But for now, Walt,
welcome to the fire.
And I hung that last stick and climbed on it, and it slid down like 2 feet down the tree. And it was just like two giant bolt marks all the way, just dug and just green as can be.
Yeah.
And it slid. I mean, I would hardly say that's not really a malfunction. It's more of just something that
it's a tough tree to climb. Smooth bark trees are tough, man.
It's hard with any stick.
I climb magnolias pretty often that are wet, and that bark is kind of peely to begin with. And there's more than one time that I'll put weight on it, and you kind of learn. You put weight on it, and you let it shift a little bit, and then you put a little more weight on it, and then you're like, okay, I'm good to go. Same thing with I almost said shag. I guess shag bark trees too, but shortleaf pine trees have like a really flaky bark. And so like a lot of times you'll put weight on that, and it's just like, boom. And it's not the stick's fault. You couldn't get it. Yeah. You can't get it tight enough to not have it slide. Like,
but you mentioned that the tethered one sticks do not do that. I think for me, I have used like daisy chain type attachments for sticks. Yep. And sometimes they're great. Like that's what I had on the custom gear sticks before I had the ones. And the daisy chains, I get it. They're convenient. They're a little bit easier. But that what's the system? What's the attachment system called? I can't remember for the one sticks, the tethered loop thing, that little figure eight deal. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, no, I do.
Jesus, it has a Christ name. We're terrible at doing an ad because I don't know what it's called.
It's something locked.
I hit record, by the way. I don't know if you noticed.
I didn't know.
I hit record because I felt like Walt, that the tree stand safety stuff is good to talk about. I really do. I think we're at the end of the season. People have shared stories. I know of three or four people, one guy here close, you know, that fell from a tree and broke his back.
Yep.
It happens every year. We're at the end of the season, and it is super avoidable. You're a little bit more of a stickler on it than I am.
Oh, pun intended. Stickler. Yeah.
But yes. Yeah, good one. But the one sticks with that attachment method. And I also had it with, I guess it was the Hawk sticks. I felt like I could tighten that a little bit better. That's what it was. It was the rope mod. When I did the rope mod,
Dynalock.
Dynalock. Yes, that's what it's called. You're able to actually tighten it, and with the tethered system, particularly with the Amsteel, I feel like it's a little bit more, like it digs into the tree a little bit more. It has more of a cut, and and then you can get some leverage, you know, and pull it underneath. And then start your Dynalock figure eight thing.
Yep.
And that has kept those sticks in place, even on the smooth bark tree. Like you say, it's hard to climb a smooth bark tree. It is, but it has not been an issue in the last, I guess, three seasons since those came out, since I got those. So there's your tether dad.
There's
right
your tether
off the
dad.
Bat.
Yep. And a smooth one like that. The intro just did this and faded out, and our voices just faded in into a nice dialogue. I had no idea we were recording, and hopefully I didn't say anything.
Do you think it cancels it out when we talk about how good it was, though?
No, I think it's kind of like bragging about being a winner. Like, everybody knows it, but you just kind of have to rub it in just a little bit more so they never forget it. That's not exactly at all what you're supposed to do.
Tree stand, I always had a fear when I was using a climber.
Yeah,
because when I used a climber, I didn't use a harness.
That's the only time I've ever fallen, by the way, was out of a climber.
Yeah. Well, there's so many different components that can fail, right? You got welds, you've got straps, you got those chains or whatever they are that get old, pins, you know, like there's so many things that can go wrong in a climber. And honestly, most people that I know that have hunted from a climber for their whole life have had close calls where they didn't get hurt, but they had something happen where they could have gotten hurt. Yep. And I'm just like, you know, I remember thinking, sitting up in my climber, I just climbed a tree and it was a little bit sketchy of a tree. And I was like, man, it's my time's coming. It's coming, you know? Yeah. And thankfully I was able to get into a saddle, and I have not had that feeling since I got into a saddle. I've had a couple sketchy climbs, you know, difficult trees to climb and things, but man, I've never felt unsafe especially once you get harnessed in. Like, I just never, even if I fell, like, I've had those butt pucker moments, you know, where you kind of, your weight shifts and you kind of swing. I've had those, but I mean, I wasn't going to get hurt. even if I had a heart attack and just passed out right there because I was scared, I just hung there, you know?
Yeah.
I'd have been safe.
It's funny. I am very much scared of heights, and Matt is listening to this and probably laughing because he's seen it. And I have like some mild anxiety about falling, both having fallen myself, but also having my dad fall, which, you know, I've talked about a lot of the podcast. But it's funny because back in 2018, when I got the Mantis, the OG Mantis, I was in my backyard, climbed up the tree. My wife is sitting there just adding all of this anxiety because she's like, what are you doing hanging from a rope in a tree? Like, this doesn't make any sense. And I'm going through it all, and I'm telling her, and I'm inspiring confidence in myself, and I'm up there in the tree, and I'm just kind of swinging like everybody does when they're in their saddle, whether it's a veteran or not, right? And I go to like look over my left shoulder, and I just step like off to the right as if I just had platform for days. I think I just inspired that much confidence. Do you remember Greg making that post on Facebook about this?
Kind of.
And I stepped off and I swung right into the tree, whap, smack into the tree. And I'm like, I'm going to die. Like, I'm dead. I fell out of my, and I'm like, oh wait, I haven't gone anywhere. And like, my wife's like, are you okay? I was like, yeah, no. You remember how I told you this thing was safe? Like, look at the stupid thing I just did. I just stepped off my platform, you know? And I've never once, like, all those jitters only occur when I'm sitting in the tree, like not in a moment. Like when a deer's behind me and I have to do the drop shot, it's an extension of my body. I lean against the ropes and I just, you know, it's awesome. But speaking of tethered, M2 vest, buy one.
Yep. I think it's easy for people to know where our minds are actually at. Like, it's hard because we live in the South, and deer season is really ramping up right now in a lot of places. I'm actually editing a video from last year right now. From January the 23rd and of 23. And it's tough. Like, I told you guys this morning, I was trying to decide if I wanted to edit a turkey video.
Yeah.
Because I want to, because I really want to. And I was like, you know, we got some late deer season stuff that I know there's a lot of people that want to see that kind of stuff. And so I'm going to edit that video up and put it up. But I am in full blown turkey. Let's just skip the BS. Let's stop talking about these deer. They've given us a run for our money. I've had a great season. You know, you've had a good season. Brett's had a great season. Matt's had, like, let's stop. Okay. We're done. We're good. We don't have to talk about these things anymore. And I know some people just really don't like this transition whenever podcasts start to transition into turkey stuff. But I'm here to tell you all, I'm here for it. And as much as I love saddles and as much as I love Tethered for the work that they've done in the saddle hunting space, I'm ready to talk about this M2 vest. Maybe until spring is over. Does that sound like a good idea? Can our Tethered ad just be about this M2 vest? Because to be honest, man, like, I'm just kind of over talking about deer hunting.
Yeah, I mean, I'm kind of that way too. We're recording this right now and our Patreon hunt is like next week. And so, like, I'm really much looking forward to hunt camp, but it really has so little to do about the deer. It's more about getting around everybody. We get to do this only twice a year and it's just such a stinking good time. But I'm with you. And I think in that same breath, we need to be telling everybody about how awesome the M2 is, but also about how well those Honeycomb custom 3-inch copper pots that we got for sale right now fit into that vest.
That's right.
Those things are wicked. Let's just say that. I bet my wife is jealous of how much I fondle my turkey calls. But man, I'm going to tell you something. He makes a call that you can just keep pairing different things with it, different strikers, different grips and postures. It is such a versatile freaking call. And he's got a limited run right now on his website of Florida sourced pecan, I should say, pot calls that you can go on the website and buy. They're at Honeycomb Custom Calls, links in the show notes. And he's got the JB special and the Not Safe for Work, which I think it's hysterical, by the way. I got to listen to the Honeycomb podcast. He couldn't remember the name of his own call, and he had it all printed out and everything.
So you want to hear what's funny? I was like, I'm pretty sure that's the Not Safe for Work, but he actually called it that other call. That's what he called it. That's what it says on the packaging. Yeah, it says, or on his Instagram ad, he called it that other call because nobody can remember NSFW or whatever.
Oh, I didn't know that.
When I see NSFW, I immediately think, like, I don't know why, I think like only like adult film. Yeah. That's all I can think of. So when I first saw it, I was like, I don't even know what that means. NSFW, it just doesn't seem like it's good.
Yeah.
It seems sinful.
That was kind of the idea of the name, though. It's like, there's a call. Those two calls pair with themselves so well. You've got the JB special and its ability to do all of the soft, subtle things. And I'm going to say this right now because I get this question all the time, even when even from patrons. That call, you have got to apply as little tongue pressure and as little airflow as humanly possible. You don't realize, and I wish I could name drop other calls without it being tacky, but how much airflow you really need in those other calls comparatively. And so a lot of people are getting great sounds out of the JB because it has a great mid range, but it is so soft. Like, you can whisper on that call, but mm-hmm. the Not Safe for Work is its own unique sound profile. You can really rip on that thing. And so when I was sitting here thinking about, you know, the names of the original series we did, the Not Safe for Work kind of made sense because you can really kind of like holler at them. You know, it's kind of like a cat call of sorts. And so for me, it was just a nice little pairing there. But I'm glad he changed the name, honestly. It gives it some fresh life.
Yeah, well, did he change the name?
I don't know.
It seems like he just called it That Other Call. I think it's just called That Other Call.
That's funny. Let's see here.
I'm pulling up. Pretty sure that's what it is. Yeah, we don't know what we're talking about with most of the products that we're going to talk about. And this one actually has our logo on it. Look at that. But it is true. Like, the JB special kind of got all the love. Yeah. Last year and
he did. He changed it to that other call on the website. That's funny.
Yep. Yeah, I thought he did. That's good to know. That's good to know. I didn't actually realize it was the Not Safe for Work. That was that other call.
Yeah.
Because I actually liked the Not Safe for Work. I used it when I wasn't using the JB special. I was using that one because, like you said, I could get some really good tone. I could get some of those. I could still do some of the soft clucks and whines and things if I really, really worked on it. But so it was pretty versatile. But I could definitely cut, like, on the Not Safe for Work or that other call. I could cut really, really hard, and I could expect that it was going to be obnoxiously loud and still sound good. So people definitely need to go check out those calls.
Again, yeah, I'm looking right now. They've got only 7 of the SoCo coppers left. So if you're looking for a pot call, it's a copper over slate in a Florida sourced pecan. In fact, shout out to Graybeard and Chris for bringing me that pecan from their farm. You got 7 of them there left. They're good calls, man.
Heck yes. Well, I just got a brand new bow set up the other day. It's the Bowtech Core SS, and I've got to tell you, buddy, I'm not going to use it for turkeys. It actually it hurts my feelings when people talk about shooting turkeys with a bow. Mostly, it doesn't hurt my feelings like people think talking about shooting it for themselves. Just thinking about me trying to hunt a turkey with a bow, it hurts my feelings. You know, like I think we're going to have Jordan Barnes on here sometime soon. to Chad about bow hunting for turkeys, and that guy's insane. He kills more turkeys with a bow than I kill with a shotgun. But I'm having these conflicts of interest in my life right now because it's still deer season, and I still want to think about bows, and I still want to think about saddles, and I still like I just got a brand new saddle that I'm hunting out of right now, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I just also got this brand new Core SS that I'm using. I got tuned up, and so I'm kind of having a conflict of interest because I'm super jacked about this bow. Brett got his set up before I did because I was on the tour.
Yep.
And he kept saying he had a few things that he said over and over and over again about this Core SS. Is that one of the things was that it was so stable. Once he got on target, he could not get off of it. That is something that I like. It's kind of hard to get used to, if I'm being honest with you, like not kind of wobbling a little bit. That bow mm-hmm. is so stable due to the center mass technology that it's got. Like, and when you think about a whole system, the IMS rest, the center mass, technology with the sight, and then the tight spot quiver, you have virtually nothing hanging off the sides of that bow.
Mm-hmm.
Like it's just a slim line package. And so once you get to full draw and you're like, there's nothing pulling you either way. It's amazing. And so that was one thing. The other thing was that this bow was tuned in like 10 arrows. Tuned and sighted into 40 yards in like 10 arrows. I felt kind of bad taking it into the woods because I was like, I feel like I haven't shot it enough, but I mean, it was like dead nuts at 40, you know. Yep. Like I was shooting better than I ever have. And I say all that to say, you know, there's a lot of good bows out there. There really are. There's a lot of great bows. There's a lot of good flagship bows, man. Some of the bows that we used from Bowtech this past season were phenomenal. There's a lot of great bows, but if you're looking for a bow that, number one, you can tune quickly. I've had tuning issues in the past. Mm-hmm. My build, my size, my draw length, I've had issues. This bow seems to have solved those issues for me. If you're looking for a bow that you can tune yourself, if you're a nerd like Brett is, if you're an archery nerd and you like to do all the stuff yourself, there's not a better bow on the market. There's not a more easily tunable bow on the market than the Bowtech. And specifically, they just introduced the time lock. And then the, again, we know nothing of what we're talking about. It's the time lock and the,
cam lock.
Is that what it is? Is it cam lock?
Cam lock and time lock. Time lock's a new version. They had cam lock last year, but I think it's the time lock that they introduced.
They have both
year.
Of them now. They still have, yeah. They have both of them. Then they
and
have
Allen
grip
Wrench
lock.
Tunes your entire dead gumbo.
Absolutely. And like I said, dude, I'm an idiot when it comes to bow stuff. Like I'm not that smart. And aside from this first initial tune, I feel confident that from here on out, I'll be able to do anything I need to on that bow because it's so easy to adjust. I don't have a bow press. I don't have anything like that, but man, I gotta say, dude, I am blown away. And you know, as well as I do, Walt, that I'm not easily blown away most mm-hmm. of the time. Like if there's like a small little thing, I'm like, flip that little, that little problem. You know, I'm pretty particular. I try not to get impressed easily. And, this bow is, man, next level, freaking next level.
It's funny what you said, because everything you've said, I've heard you say before. And I thought myself, the only thing I hadn't heard you say before that I thought myself was the bit about you felt bad taking it out. Because I felt the same way about that Diamond Deploy SB. I've said that like every episode now, but like it is one of those things where when it's an extension of you, it's an extension of you. And the bows are clearly made. And we have to give credit to Kanati because they make a freaking stellar arrow that just does exactly what you need it to do. But I was in the backyard, you know, and we talked earlier this summer. It's really funny. We talked earlier this summer and somebody asked in the Patreon group, hey, how long does it take you to sight in your bow? And I was like, a couple hours. Right. And Matt's like, the hell with that, man. It normally only takes me about 20 minutes to have the whole thing dialed in and ready for elk. And I'm like, wow, I guess I just really suck. And I don't necessarily know that I suck, but I don't know that I've ever had a bow with the level of confidence and the setup with the level of integrity and like and frictionless pieces that I've had to where I could shoot 20 arrows and be like, holy crap, I've got this thing locked in. You know, I had my bow set to 28, which is normally what I draw. It needed to be shortened just a touch. So I waited about a week longer. I could have shot, but in like a compromised position, it would have kind of left me a little overextended. So I moved it back down to 27.5 inches. And dude, it's lights out to 40. I mean, like I'm not shooting at the same dot at 40. I have got a big 48 inch bag target that I've got in the backyard. I've got four or five different dots on that thing that I shoot at. Cause I'm not, first off, I like my Kanadi arrows too much, but I don't want to just bust arrows at this point. It's awesome, yeah, man. It's when you work with people who have frictionless setups like Tethered, like Bowtech, you're starting to hopefully see a theme with the people we work with. They remove those friction points to where you just get to enjoy the process of hunting and being outside or shooting whatever it is and not worried about your stuff.
Well, I think it goes without saying, you know, we've talked on this podcast a lot about our Patreon group and the guys who are on it, always offering feedback, always, you know, and I feel like we have a pretty good bead on the demographic of people who listen to this show. Ultimately what it comes down to, we have a lot of people who listen to our show, watch our content, whatever, who are working class people. Many of them work 9-to-5 jobs, you know, some of them are factory employees and things like that. The reality is most people don't have the time to invest into being as hardcore into the outdoor stuff and arrow building and bow tuning as some of us are. They literally don't have the time. And so that's why we tend to work with the companies that do things just like this. Yeah. And, you know, we hope to see more of that in the future. I can tell you one thing, Walt, I am going to have a hard time giving this bow up.
Yeah.
For them.
That's right.
Awesome.
Yeah. Well, you talk about a guy that's got everything simplified down to a easy to follow process. It's Shane Simpson, which is this week's guest. And I mean that both kind of tongue in cheek, because the guy is such a complex turkey hunter, but he's so simplified. You guys are going to hear, I mean, he's using the same shotguns that he's had with the same rattle can paint job with the same face paint. And I sincerely doubt he's changed much. But while his approach is complex, the system and the way he goes about it is so simple. He hunts out of a fanny pack, even with all of his camera gear. And the guy has forgotten in the last two seasons more about turkey hunting than I ever will learn in my entire lifetime. I mean, the guy is just unbelievable. And I have had the fortune of meeting him in person in a like one-on-one space where I could talk to him and pick his brain. And every year I get to chat with him personally, and I'm very lucky to do so. So as a result, I was thrilled to be able to bring him to you guys again this week. Parker, you couldn't make it, but the JB special did. And we had a good time.
Man, I'm looking forward to hearing this episode. I was pretty bummed that I didn't get to be on this one. I was filming a project for a buddy of mine doing a 40-mile ultra run in the 5-degree weather. It was pretty wild. So I was a little bit preoccupied, really wanted to think about and talk about turkeys, but I wasn't able to. So Shane is always one of my favorite interviews that I've ever been able to do. Just an easy, cool guy to talk to. And he knows what the heck he is talking about when it comes to turkeys. And I also appreciate how he's so detailed. When we start talking about tactics, start talking about gear, like you said, he has everything down to a science, and he is not hesitant to share any of that. That's one of the things I've always appreciated about Shane, is his willingness to share and educate. So dude, I am freaking looking forward to this one.
And take people. Every year you watch his YouTube channel, he finds several people to take, and I mean, has a great time with it. I can't think of a better role model in this space than Shane Simpson. So we're going to have a whole lot of fun talking to him. I hope you guys enjoy it. This intro has gone on long enough. Let's put a pin in it right there.
Yes, sir.
This upcoming concert season will be all about the boots, and Tecovas is your stop for the best in Western style. Tecovas has seasonal and limited edition offerings this spring and summer, including men's and women's boots, apparel, hats, bags, and more. Altacovas boots are made by hand in a time-honored tradition with timeless styles that are always on trend. And Tecovas has first wear comfort with little to no break-in period. It's hard to find this level of comfort paired with this level of style. Stop by your local Tecovas store, have a complimentary drink or two, that's WCB style, and shop new styles. The smell of fresh leather and friendly staff are at your service. Many stores even have leather custom branding to make your boots truly personalized. And with regular live music and events, there's no in-store experience like it. If you can't make it into a store, just visit tecovas.com. That's T-E-C-O-V-A-S.com. They offer free shipping on all boots, as well as free returns and exchanges, and ship right to your door. Go to tecovas.com and find your new favorite pair of boots today.
Fishing like a local isn't just about catching fish. It's about connecting with the environment and the people who call it home. It's about hearing the stories and traditions that have been passed down for generations and sharing unforgettable moments with the people you meet along the way. Fishing like a local is having an experience that stays with you forever. And with Fishing Booker, you can experience it too, no matter where you are. Discover your next adventure on Fishing Booker.
All right, everybody. We are back with another episode with a guest that I had on. It feels like I've had him on every year, and it's a delight. There are some people that, you know, you could take and sit at a campfire with either some oysters or a beverage of your choice and just pick their brain and talk and talk and talk. And you never run out of things that you just run from topic to topic, and it'd be a great dialogue. And so I'm hoping today's an extension of that. No pressure, Shane. We're going to be talking turkey with the one and only Shane Simpson. I got Joey Bell here with me. Gentlemen, as I sit, we are exactly on the nose 2 months away from turkey season. And if it wasn't for an upcoming deer hunt I have planned, I would have it all put away. My turkey gun would be sleeping with me next to the bedside, and I'd just be living for opening day. Shane, I don't know if you can get into that groove as cold as it is up there right now.
I actually, over my left shoulder, I have my 12 gauge torn apart, getting it ready for turkey season. I was moving my red dot on it, and then I decided to start cleaning it. So yeah, I'm in turkey mode. I've been editing turkey videos, so I've got the bug pretty bad right now. But
I think cold weather does it. Yeah.
Well, yeah, cabin fever.
It's this time every year. Yeah, yeah. And I feel like there's like a view to spring where everything's green, but before you have that green up, you have to have something looking not green. And so it's about this time of year you start looking forward to things looking like spring again. But
that definitely
I appreciate definitely the fact that.
Sorry, there must be a delay here.
Yeah, I think so. I'll start slowing down just to accommodate. Go ahead, buddy.
I was going to say that it definitely gets me more hyped for spring with the winters in Minnesota, because they're so brutally cold, and you're basically stuck indoors for 3 or 4 months. And so turkey season, the green up and warmer weather really makes it, I think going through that winter makes you appreciate the spring so much more.
Yeah, we're getting a little taste of that here in Tennessee. We got 7 inches of snow yesterday, and we woke up to single digit temps this morning, and it's not going to get above freezing for the next few days. So we're getting a little taste of it. We're all holed up in here too. I can't leave my house for the foreseeable future. There's one snowplow in the whole county, I think.
You realize that you guys, 7 inches, you have more snow than we've had all winter up here. It's been a drought.
I remember you saying something like that when I talked to you on the phone when we were chatting about that, the owl hooter or whatever. You were saying something.
Yeah, so we've had like 3 snowfalls, and each of them were about an inch or less. And the first two were gone pretty much the next day. This one now we've got, it's like an inch of snow. It's stuck around just because it's so brutally cold up here and it's not going anywhere. But this is you're talking about we normally have 1.5 feet, 2 feet of snow on the ground by now. We've got nothing on the ground but a dusting.
Man. You were saying you were tearing apart your 12 gauge. Are you switching back to a 12 gauge this year? I thought you usually, or at least you shot a 20, was it last year or sometime in the past?
No, I have a 20 gauge I carry as a backup. I've shot a couple birds with it in the past, but I don't really hunt with it. It's primarily just if my 12 gauge breaks, I've got a gun in with me that I can hunt with. So especially when I'm out traveling, but it's hard for me to give up my 12 gauge, even though it has more recoil. It's a bigger gun, you know, and I probably don't need all that gun. When you've hunted with it for so long, it becomes a part of you. I love carrying it. And I know it, you know, front and back, but I am making some changes to it just because I missed a couple birds last year and it gets mentally, that gets under my, you know, gets to me.
Mm-hmm.
I move my red dot out from where it's normally mounted, where the holes are tapped right above the receiver. I have one of those Meadow Creek mounts and I mounted it out on the rib. So it's above my pump, actually the pump, where you put your hand. And with that, you get more accuracy. The farther away the red dot is from your eye, the more accurate it is. So even if you kind of flinch a little bit, you're still on. And, yeah, and I put a more open choke in my gun. I'm trying everything I can to quit missing. I don't know what it is. I miss more lately than I have ever in my life, and it's bothering me. And I'm trying to.
Out of curiosity, what do you consider? So, like, again, new. I'm of the group here. I don't even really deserve to be speaking, but I'm just curious. From a turkey choke perspective, I've got a pattern that I think is great at 40, and I wouldn't shoot past that. It's kind of open. Personally, like, what do you have in that gun? Do you have like a last year? Did you have like a 60 yard choke in there, or like how open did you get?
Well, I've been running the factory choke for years, which is a 670, and that's a pretty open choke, and it shoots. You know, it gives me a pattern at, let's say 25 yards. That's big, about the size of a basketball, the core of the pattern, which I've been okay with, but I don't like it that tight. That doesn't sound tight to some people. Some people like a baseball at that range. I actually put a slightly bigger, like a 675 in there, and that didn't open it much at all. And that's the thing with TSS, though. TSS, the choke doesn't play a huge part, or as much of a part as lead shot shot shells do. So what I have in it now, I went through, rummaged through all my chokes that I have. I actually have, I think it's a modified or something that I have in it right now that I'm going to go shoot. I'm just trying to get at 30 yards, I want a nice, evenly distributed pattern that's bigger than a basketball at 30 yards. Because most of the turkeys I shoot are inside 30 yards. Most of them actually are within 20 yards. I mean, they're tight. And, you know, the last two turkeys, this is what's odd, though. I missed a couple birds last year. One was at like 35 yards. One was at 20. And in between those two misses, I killed two birds less than 20 yards away and you know, hit them, you know, No issue at all. And you'd think at a farther distance with the pattern open a little bit more, I wouldn't miss, but I don't know what's going on. Now, I was in an odd position on the first miss, and then the second one, I think he just dodged it. He darted behind a tree right when I shot. So it's not entirely my fault, I don't think, just looking at the footage, but it certainly mentally gets to me.
What load are you shooting, Shane?
I have a variety of loads, 8x10s, TSS, and straight 9s, and some 9x10s. So I kind of play around with each of those. I like having more pellets, you know, a lot of pellets. It just makes me feel good that I'm covering every little square inch. No, there's no gaps. I don't know. I got a bunch of different loads here. I got some hand loads that are number 8s. I got some, some 9, the blends and all that good stuff. And I'm going to go shoot them and just see what gives me the best confidence after I shoot a couple rounds of each. It gets really expensive, so I'm going to just shoot a couple rounds of each.
Yeah, I ran a 670 choke out of my 12 gauge for years. I probably 20 years, nearly as long as I had the gun. And I'm like you, I loved having all the pellets that I could fit into a shell. So for a couple of years, I shot a 3.5 inch Federal, the 8x10 blend, and there was 1,000 mm-hmm. pellets in that thing. And it threw a pretty good pattern, you know, even with the 670. I think there were just so many pellets that I still had way too many strays because I was just getting way too many pellets in the meat. Even though I had a really good core pattern, there were just so many pellets. Like there just wasn't space for them to go, I guess. So they had to go somewhere. So that's where I got a bunch of flyers. And then last year I dropped down to a 3 inch, I think it was straight nines or something. And my patterns got a lot better. And actually before this season, it was after last season. I didn't really know that at the time I was going to switch guns, but I went on Apex's website and I got a 2.75 shell. I forget, it may have been nines or whatever, but it still had, you know, way more pellets than you would get in a, you know, 3 to 3.5 inch number 6 shot, you know, lead shell. And I was actually going to use that, but then I made the switch to a 28 gauge this year. And so I got to get it back from Gunsmith and start patterning with it. But I think there is a break point of having too many pellets. Even it doesn't matter what choke you have, like you said, the 670, maybe even the 675. When you try to shoot 1,000 pellets downrange, it's, I think it just has a hard time just holding like together. That's almost too much. mm-hmm. Yeah. So I think if you just drop down in, you know, shell size and pellet size, then it just makes a little bit more room and it's more efficient, I think.
Yeah, I've had some good results with TSS number 8s, you know, and I look at the pellet counts, you know, what it looks like on paper. I'm not counting the pellets, but I'm looking at how dense the pattern is with the 9s and 10s, mm-hmm. and it's hard for me to go back to 8s. But then I tell myself, you know, Shane, you hunted for the first 20 years or whatever of your life, turkeys, you hunted with number 6 lead. And thought that was fine. And there was people hunting with number 4, number 5 lead. And I would never go to that size pellet because, you know, to me, that's not enough pellets in a gun, in a shot shell for turkeys. I want some pattern density. But at the same time, I keep telling mm-hmm. myself number 8s is perfectly fine. And I always worry mm-hmm. about getting too small TSS that I'm losing effectiveness. You're throwing...
Yeah.
You know, the energy, by the calculations, the energy is there, but it still bothers me because I've seen instances of turkeys that have a delayed response after getting hit with TSS. I think those pellets just zip right through them. There's no impact or energy being transferred. And so it's the trauma is slightly delayed before it actually, you know, hemorrhaging and just killing them. So I had one that actually shot and he took like 2 flaps into the air, like he was getting ready to get out of there. And then he just fell to the ground. I'm like, that gives me some concern, you know? So, I may end
and especially
up
when you get
going
to
number 8.
Yeah. When, you got some guys that shoot them at, those, you know, longer ranges, like 50 to 60 yards. And you're throwing a number 10 TSS pellet. Like you said, the energy is there, but just, you know, that tiny of a pellet going that far, it just can't do that much damage. I'm with you there. I need a little bit more energy and a little bit bigger projectile, I guess we should say.
Yep.
My whole logic I'm with you on the pellet count just because I know there's a lot of people who are really upset about TSS and the range it provides, but I only get to hunt Saturday and Sunday mornings. And if I can put 3-4 times as many pellets inside a range, because my furthest shot is 56 yards, my average is 26 yards. And the 56, I've told a story on the podcast, I didn't mean to take that shot. I thought he was a lot closer than he was. He was just in the wide open, in the pines, new turkey hunter. But most of my shots are up close. And so I tend to go for like a, you know, Clay loads those 8.5s for me. 8.5 has kind of been the sweet spot for me. And I've got like a solid 30-inch pattern at 40 yards. where it's just you can't put a neck and a turkey head in there with that 20 gauge without, you know, maybe it's 24 inches probably now that I think about it, where I've just got that forgiveness up, down, left, right. If I punch the trigger out of excitement, at least I know, because it's hard, especially down here with all the pressure we get. If you get an opportunity, I want that confidence, but I cannot take the kick of that 12, man. That thing is just brutal.
So I do have, you were talking about the 20. I do have my 20 gauge. I actually have all my guns in this room right now. I'm tinkering with all of them. I say all my guns, my daughter's guns and my guns. I have her youth model 20, which is a little, it's like 24 inches long total. You know, it's a teeny gun. It's a 20 gauge.
Wow.
And then it's the Mossberg mini Bantam. And then her 410 is about the same length. I mean, I could have that thing on my shoulder, you know, on a, what do you call it, the sling, and tossed over my back, and you will not see the gun at all behind my back. It's that small. and I'm tinkering with, you know, using those just for the less recoil, and because it's such a small gun, I can see me maneuvering through the woods. I'm getting, I don't know if you've noticed over the years, I carry less and less every year. I try to carry less and less gear. I'm trying to get down to just a shotgun and a mouth call, you know, aside from the camera equipment. And I'm like, yeah, I should take this little mini Bantam 20 gauge. It'd be less recoil. It's a smaller gun. I don't know. I just things I think about, I guess. I probably don't need to. And then, but you're talking about that recoil, the 20 gauge. I sometimes think that is part of the reason I'm missing also is I've gotten recoil shy or something. I think I'm anticipating that kick and I'm flinching or something. I don't know.
Really, out in the field, you think you still have that flinch? I can understand it because I have the same thing, you know,
well,
when you're on the range or whatever.
I was editing one of my videos, and I can look at it from, you know, I have those angles from action cameras from different angles, and they're not at a high enough frame rate where I can watch it in slow motion, but I can flick frame by frame. And in one hunt where I didn't miss, I did kill the turkey. I did notice that right when I went, right as my finger is squeezing the trigger, my head shifts like it's trying to like look up and see if I killed the turkey or anticipating the shot or something. In one frame, I can see my head just shift ever so slightly off the stock, and I'm like, ooh, I bet I'm moving my head, and that's why I may have missed. Back to my Mossberg, one thing I haven't taken apart, before I put it back together, I'm waiting on a new trigger spring and trigger assembly springs, hammer spring, trigger spring. It's going to reduce the pull from the factory 8 3/4 pounds down to 4 pounds. I think that will help too, because my gun does, even when I'm sighting it in or patterning it, my gun, it takes a lot of effort to pull that trigger, and I think that's contributing to misses. So I don't know. Hopefully I can get over this, solve this problem and stop missing turkeys. I used to, when I was younger, I would go seasons without missing turkeys. Now it seems like I have at least one miss a season, which is to me ridiculous.
I see a lot of people nowadays that are changing the trigger springs out on their shotguns. And I did it last year on my Benelli, and that was the first thing I did with this new 28 gauge is I switched out the trigger spring. And it makes a world of difference because I think from the factory, a lot of these shotguns, they are pulling like, you know, 6 7-pound triggers sometimes, you know, and it takes, when you just sit there and dry fire it, you realize it takes a lot of pressure just to pull the trigger. And so when you couple that with recoil anticipation or whatever, yeah, it's very understandable how, you know, misses happen and flinching and everything else. But it, I think they do it as like a safety thing, you know, I guess coming from the factory, they don't want to
like it's not a legal thing, but a, to prevent losses.
Liability or something.
Liability. Yeah. I mean, I wish I'd put a, thinking back on this, I wish I'd put a lesser spring on my daughter's guns. When she first started hunting, she had to use two fingers to pull the trigger just to shoot it.
Oh, wow.
You know, it's, you know, Mossberg, like I said, it's nearly a 9-pound factory Mm-hmm. Ooh, which is a lot.
Yeah. 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 Well, they make it easy nowadays. I think it's M Carbo. That's the company that has.
That's where I got mine from.
Springs.
Yeah, that's where I got mine from.
And it's super easy to change out. You know, they have a lot of videos that step by step on how to do this. And I was a little intimidated at first before I did my Benelli last year. But I mean, you get you a couple punches from the hardware store and punch those out, drop the trigger, you know.
You don't even need a punch.
I mean,
I just take
Allen. Yeah, you probably use an Allen wrench or screwdriver or whatever. Yeah,
it's pretty easy to get apart.
Definitely, and so when
definitely
I did
something
that,
you can do yourself. And
absolutely, absolutely. Yeah, it takes you, I mean, even if you're not that experienced, it'll take you less than 30 minutes, you know, at max, and that's probably being very generous.
Mm. And it's reversible. If you put that spring in there and you don't like it, you can put it back. You know, the old school means of filing down the trigger, now you're looking at, did I take off too much? And my buddy called me because I said the same thing. It's funny you brought this up because this is something I was going to actually end up asking you as you went down that path. He was telling me how he likes 4, 4.5 on his 870. I think it's an 870 he's shooting. But he was telling me how he had to order a new kit one time because he's filing it down. And he's like, I breathed too much. And it's like a 2.5, you know, pound trigger suddenly. And so when I looked at those M Carbo kits, like you talked about, I got one for my deer rifle come in. I've got one for the 320, I think, as well, or the 870, I should say. But I was hesitant. And then I watched the tutorial. I'm like, oh man, I just take this bolt off and put the spring on there and put it back together. And if I don't like it, you know, I can't screw this up, you know?
Yeah, that's exactly what I did. I watched I was searching, you know, I was on Google searching around like how to reduce the trigger, you know, sensitivity, or increase the sensitivity, I guess, just make it easier to fire. And I stumbled on one of their videos and watched their tutorials. And I'm like, yeah, I'm getting that. I mean, reducing my pull by more than half. Like you said, Joey, I think, even if I am still flinching, the gun's going off before I have a chance to flinch, or at least that's the hope.
Mm-hmm.
But it's still my trigger. Because I have a little set screw, I can adjust the take up in the trigger.
Yeah,
I'm gonna leave that because I always keep that in there. I like to be able to touch the trigger and pull it back. It's like an eighth of an inch, and know that my finger's on there. You know, and so it's still it's very safe. It's just I think it's gonna eliminate some of that flinch missing if that's what I'm doing.
You seem to be pretty, you know, I don't want to say set in your ways, but you've been pretty consistent in the things that you've done over the years, you know, just watching your videos and how you turkey hunt and how you approach traveling. What are some things that maybe have changed over the years as far as either gear or tactics, you know, with so much information available to us nowadays, has there been anything that you've changed over the years that you maybe used to not do or that you don't do anymore that you used to do?
Well, I mean, other than the gear, like I don't use decoys anymore. I don't use a turkey vest anymore. I found that sitting on the ground on my butt is more comfortable than any pad out there on any turkey vest. And that was just, I guess that's the way I was taught. You know, I had to have a vest when I first started turkey hunting when I was a kid, and I never sat without one. And then one day I was hunting without one. I couldn't sit with one for some reason, the way the tree, there was like roots or something. I forget what it was. And I just sat down there and I was like, you know what? My butt didn't go numb. I didn't have to constantly shift. Obviously eventually you're going to have to move and you're going to, but I was like, this was much more comfortable at a longer period of time than any vest. So I quit using a pad to sit on. I started using a, you know, that fanny pack, a tactical fanny pack with a bunch of little pockets and stuff. That was my go-to. And then Tethered came out with that M2 vest. And so I tried that out last year. I liked that. First thing I did was take the pad, the turkey seat pad off of it and throw it in the box. And I don't hunt with it. I'm torn whether to – I like that vest. It's a very good vest. I can carry a lot of camera equipment and a lot of extra batteries. But I do carry my little fanny pack with me because I probably will hunt with it occasionally and not carry the M2 on those hunts where I know I can get by with even less gear. As far as actual hunting, what have I changed? You know, I have Onyx, you know, and other mapping apps are out there these days. that certainly has played in a part in the way I hunt. I'm more, I guess, aggressive in areas I go to, knowing what it looks like ahead of time. Back in the day, I used to use paper maps and stuff, and they were just basically color-coded. Like, it would be green to represent trees, and then, like, white and, you know, different things like that. And you just, anybody's guess what was back there. So it's definitely made me more aggressive and more willing to go deeper, knowing that, you know, it's not such a mystery way back in there to some of these spots. And it's definitely helped me pinpoint areas that most likely have turkeys quicker.
You know, it's funny. I'm a big fan of your YouTube channel, largely because I feel like you're a no-nonsense turkey hunter. There's a lot of guys out there with, and I'm not trying to throw shade per se, but when you start toting camera gear, you start having to prioritize what matters. And I like to self-film, obviously. And so I find myself paring down more and more, and I watch how you go about things, and you're very minimalist. You're very old school with the face paint. And I love that because I hate having a mask over my ears. And I'm a big fan of painting up whenever, I don't have to potentially jump on a Zoom call, if you can read between the lines. Yeah. But it's interesting to me. Last year I went with a chest harness. So I got the marsupial chest harness, and I put a little monocular on one side, my locator calls on the left side. And then basically if I could fit it in there after camera batteries and stuff like that, it went in there. And I feel like I had a lot more fun that way because I didn't feel heavy. I got their hydration pack as well. So for longer hunts, I could have some water on me because down here, that's kind of imperative. And everybody in the group, my little social group, was laughing and laughing and laughing about me, about how I was making such a mountain out of a molehill trying to go minimalist. And then I started hunting with them, and I threw that on. They're like, "That's all you're taking?" I was like, "It's all right here, man. I got my extra batteries. I got my ZV1. I got the whole nine." And I think Parker at the end of a couple of days, like, "Man, that's a pretty sweet little setup there." He's like, where'd you get that? And so hopefully that's something a lot of people can think about, because I've got buddies, I'll take 30 pounds of turkey calls into the woods with them. I'm like, that's got to mess your like mindset up when you get tired.
Being going minimalist, or carrying as little as possible, there's a lot of advantages to it. I mean, just watch turkey videos, watch my videos, watch people I hunt with. Let's touch on the face paint first. I've always hated wearing a face mask. It's just that I was embarrassed to use face paint because, you know, you're going to the store after you hunt and you got all that stuff on you. I've gotten to the age now, I don't give a shit what people think, what I look like. I go turkey hunting and I've got face paint all over me. I go into the convenience store and I just walk right in there and I get all kinds of looks, but I don't care because, you know, I'm out there to kill a turkey. I'm just stopping in the store to get something to eat. But you watch, as far as the amount of gear you carry, it does affect your hunting. It affects how you hunt. Let's touch on decoys. I used to use decoys, and you know, you got a gobbler there. Now you've got to move out there and set up a decoy, and then you back away from them. You get set up. The turkey's not coming in for whatever reason. Now you need to make a move, and that's affecting how you think about your next move or whether you move or not. Now you got to crawl out there and try to get this decoy without getting busted, and pack it away, and then move on the bird, or just leave it there. And that was one of the reasons I got rid of using those, is because, you know, it just affected my ability to be, I guess, a stealthy in the woods, or a killer in the woods. You know what I mean? Trying to move, be the top tier predator. You know, if I can just use woodsmanship and move around without having to worry about extra gear, or ground blind, or decoy, that really worked to my advantage. And a lot of people don't think about that. You know, people throw shade on people for using ground blinds. You got to hunt out of a ground blind. I look at it as they're giving themselves a disadvantage because, yeah, you can move around more inside of a blind without getting busted, but you got to tote that thing. It's going to affect your decision when to move and where to move to. It's a huge advantage not to hunt with one. So if anybody throws shade at somebody for using a ground blind, they're putting themselves at a disadvantage, is what I think they're doing. And then you look at the guys using these big vests and stuff. I used to carry a turkey vest, a big vest. They sit down on their little padded seat. They still have their straps on their vest. That affects their movement when they're swinging a gun. First thing you need to do is, you know, shed those straps when you sit down on a turkey. Look at the brush that that vest grabs as you're trying to, you know, crawl on your hands and knees to get 10 yards closer to a different tree. All that stuff, it's not just going, you know, carrying less gear to be lighter, which it does allow you to conserve energy and hunt longer and go farther, but it allows you to be more stealthy in the woods and doesn't affect your decision-making to as much to a degree. If you would just go out and, you know, imagine going out there just, you know, just wearing pants and a shirt and carrying a shotgun and a mouth call, how much easily you could move through the woods without all the extra stuff. You know, everything mm-hmm. affects your hunt.
I am a big proponent of a seat pad, though, just personally, because I've always had a Hank Hill ass, you know, I just hardly ever had one. And then here in the last several months, I've lost like 40 pounds. So it even went away even further. So if I sit down on a seat cushion, my hip bones are touching the, you know, the bottom of that chair that I'm sitting in,
those little donuts, like my buddy Doug Updike carries this little inner tube, little miniature inner tube. He says those things are so comfortable.
That's like for hemorrhoids or something, isn't
it? Yeah.
I wasn't going to say it.
So if you see somebody rolling through the woods with a bottom land donut, that'll be me. I'm just going to blame Shame Simpson for giving me the idea.
You know, I have I bought a hammock and a good Lord, sleeping bag from Outdoor Vitals. And then whatever you do nowadays, whenever you buy something, they offer you like all these little free upgrades and just pay shipping and handling. And they sent me one of these like one breath pillows that you can like put in your bag and it folds up. It's mm-hmm. exactly like that, Joey. It's got this real thick Kydex bottom, not Kydex, but like Kydura or Cordura or whatever that's called. It's got like a ring in the middle where the back of your head.
Yeah.
And then the back of your head, there's like a hole on it. I toted that last year some. I'm kind of a big fan of just sitting on my butt anyways. I take my boot and kind of like make that hole in the ground just real quick next to the tree, and it sounds like a turkey scratching. But you could think about one of those. Heck, I got a couple of those. I'll bring you on the turkey hunt, man. You can run out there and do a bottom land wrap on it.
I think Glenda that makes those little turkey tote bags, satchels, I think will stitch up something for. I think she's the one that stitched up something for Doug to put around his donut. So, like, he had his in bottom land, I think.
I didn't know that. That's funny. I want one of those little satchels so badly. I just can't bring myself to walk through the woods with one of those. I feel like the gobbler would make fun of me, I guess, for carrying a satchel in the woods with me, but they look sweet, man.
That's when you call it a possibles bag. You don't call it a satchel.
Shane, where are you going to be hunting this year, man? What states are you going to hit? I'm always curious to see where you're going to go.
Last year I didn't hunt a lot or travel extensively because of that app we launched, and it's still affecting us financially as far as where I'm able to go to. I am going to South Carolina. I'm going down there because my daughter goes to a different school now. Their spring break's at a different time of the year. It's in late March. It's still early March. And so we're going to go down and visit family in South Carolina, and the season will be in on private land. Right now I have some access to some private that I'll be able to hunt. I'm thinking about jumping on over to Alabama and trying to get a bird there before I head back to Minnesota. I'll see if I can work that out. I don't know for sure yet. But for the most part, I'm going to stick to the Midwest, maybe Nebraska, South Dakota, Iowa, Minnesota, Wisconsin, and Michigan. Maybe Indiana. We'll see. But kind of just that's going to be my core area this year, like most years. But that app, like I said, we launched that tracker app, and it is – it's taken a lot of money out of myself, my pocket, and my partners that have also contributed. So hopefully we can get that turned around eventually where it starts making some money to pay for itself and we don't have to be broke all the time. But that's kind of my schedule this year.
I think I'd much rather hunt
those Midwest states anyways than down here.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. They seem like more fun. Have you kind of noticed an uptick? I think I already know the answer to this, but in the areas that you hunt, you know, you've already said you kind of stick primarily to the Midwest and, you know, that area somewhat closer to home. Are you still seeing an uptick in hunting pressure up there and in some of these other places where you go in the South? Are you seeing more people nowadays?
No, and you know, COVID was the only time I saw an uptick, and I didn't really see that. But up here in out in South Dakota, a couple of spots I went to, I never run into anybody. I ran into a couple of guys, and one was a couple of college kids who were out of school, so they decided to go turkey hunting. Mm-hmm. And in another area, it was a couple of people. Minnesota, I ran into a couple of people. Nothing too much, but that was only during, you know, 2020, right, or whatever. It's back to, you know, what it's been like for the last 15 years. I mean, I've never seen a huge, but also I hunt during the week primarily, and I go to areas where it's not popular. I don't seek out the most popular places to hunt. I try to find areas that, you know, are not listed in every magazine or like on every Facebook page. It's like, oh, I hunt here. Like I'm not going to say it, but there's a WMA not far from my house when it comes to deer hunting. Everybody mentions it. That's the last place I'm going to go deer hunting. Mm-hmm. You know, I've been out there before, but it's a zoo. And so I go to these smaller little WMAs, and I may see one or two vehicles parked there during deer season. So even in Mississippi, when I was down there hunting, people were talking about there's trucks at every gate. I did see some trucks, but they were concentrated in certain areas. Like all the area I was hunting, I got on a bird, you know, I saw one other vehicle down there in that area. And then I went to another area that had a recent burn. There were seven trucks parked at one gate. I'm like, this is the reason you guys are complaining, because you're going to where everyone else is going. Mm-hmm. Here I am from Minnesota. I rode around and I had no problem finding gates with no one parked there. It didn't seem like a whole lot of people. I think when people start complaining about hunting pressure, as far as turkey hunting pressure, there's probably a slight increase. I know there's an increase in non-resident hunting. Overall, across America, the number of turkey hunters in general has gone down. But I think the reason people are complaining about pressures is what is it? I forget the term. Basically, if you're looking for something, you're going to see it. It's like, I'll give a good example. My brother bought a Ford EXP. This is when we were younger. Never heard of the car. Never seen one in my life, or at least didn't know I'd seen one. As soon as he got the car and we started riding around in, I started seeing them all over the roads in the streets. I started noticing them, you know, and so I think that's what people notice, things they're actually looking for. My mind started looking for that Ford EXP. And so I think, but for me, maybe my mind's not looking for pressure and I'm not finding it, but maybe that's what the mentality everyone needs to get into. Hey, there's no pressure, and then you won't find it. But yeah, it doesn't seem like very much pressure to me, more than usual.
I think
I'm in the same boat as you, Shane. Yeah, I'm in the same boat as you, Shane, as far as, you know, living close to a WMA that's pretty popular. I am 10 minutes from a 15,000 acre WMA here in Middle Tennessee that's pretty popular. And it's just like you said, like on opening weekend of turkey season, it's an absolute madhouse. And there is literally a truck at every gate. And so I'm willing to make a drive to almost a 2-hour drive to another part, you know, like on the other side of the state, nearly to maybe a 3,000 acre WMA that's probably not going to have a soul in it. And I've heard birds there, you know, consistently over the last handful of years, and just drive right past this big, giant, popular WMA. I think a lot of people just need to, you know, if you really want to get away from some pressure, just take you a radius and draw it around every major city and stay out of that radius.
Yeah, that's the thing I don't understand. A lot of people aren't willing to drive. If there's not a place within less than 30 minutes from their house, they complain about, there's so many people out here and this and that. And, I mean, even here in Minnesota, 65% of the population of Minnesota lives in five counties right here in the metro. And so obviously you're going to have a lot of hunting pressure in these areas. I drive 2 to 3 hours to hunt. I mean, you're going to spend how many hours out in the woods, you know, and you're not willing to drive, you know, an hour and a half, 2 hours to get to a place that there's no one else going to be hunting. And that's what I tell people. It's like, if you don't like the fact there's a lot of people hunting this area here, you know, drive another hour and a half away out of the cities and get to a WMA or a piece of public that doesn't have as much hunting pressure. You can sit here and drive 15 minutes and compete with other people and complain all day, or you can drive 2 hours and have an enjoyable time, find gobblers that are vocal, call in one and, you know, fill your tag, you know? And so people don't think like that. I mean, they're too worried about convenience of driving a short distance than investing, you know, just a little bit of gas. And, you know, how much gas money is it going to cost you? 20, even with today's prices, it's not going to cost you, you know, $20 to drive 2 hours there and back.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think,
and then do like, the other thing do like I do, you just don't have your the truck ability. Stay overnight.
If you don't have the ability to drive 2 hours, you can also just hunt differently. There's a lot of times where I'll hunt from 12 to dark. You know, I'm lucky and I live in a state that allows that now, but you know, there are some really heavily pressured areas around here that come 11 o'clock, there's nobody in the woods anymore. And I will gladly go sit. I've learned just through convenience or through opportunities presenting themselves all day hunting. Whenever I get a Saturday to hunt, I try and I'm in the woods until I can't be there any longer. And I remember sitting in a turkey bottom one time, little hollows, a turkey honey hole. And at like 11:30, all of a sudden you just hear two or three different hens start to fire off. And I was like, that's weird. Like, I wonder what happened. So I came back, I got beat to my spot one time and I come back at like 11:45 one day. And I go back and I'm sitting in that bottom. I'm like, I'd rather just be sitting in the woods listening than go home. And all of a sudden you hear two or three hens start to fire off again. And I've gotten to the point now where, you know, don't get me wrong, first hour of daylight, I'm really excited for obvious reasons. But I mean, I don't sleep on 11 to 2 any day. And if I have to go to a party that morning for my son and I'm home by 12 and I've got 12 to 4 before dinner, I'm going to be out there from 12 to 4. I mean, it's just, there's too many opportunities, even on heavily pressured public lands. If you just, deer hunters do it all the time. Hey man, I was right behind the parking lot. No, everybody's walking right past it, you know, and I was hunting right behind the parking lot. I shot a 140, you know, and it's like, and just do the same thing. Just adapt to what your opportunity is and go. Don't sit at the house, please. Or yeah, do, you're certainly actually, gonna, please, if you're listening.
You're to certainly going
to
improve your, increase your chances of getting a bird the more time you spend out there. That's kind of a given. I used to be like that. I'd go out in the afternoons every opportunity I get. But nowadays, I don't know, maybe I have the luxury of hunting more than most people. And so especially in the late season, when those days get so long, by 2 o'clock, I've given up for the day. I'm going to catch up some rest and whatnot. But I've hunted, you know, I've been up since 3 a.m. and I've hunted until 2. So I've put in some time. Now, had I not been able to hunt that morning, I may go out that afternoon and hunt that afternoon and, you know, spend some time from, you know, 2 to 4 or 12 to 4. But it certainly makes sense, you know, get out there whenever you can. More time, obviously, you're going to increase your chances.
You, Shane, I consider you probably one of the best that I've seen as far as locating goblin turkeys or getting turkeys to gobble, because, you know, either owl calls or coyote calls or whatever else. One, I guess, and I've talked to you about this before, like what's your favorite locator call throughout the day? You know, you're talking about early morning and then maybe sometimes you quit in the middle of the afternoon if you've already put in 12 hours of hunting. But what's a locator call that you use no matter the weather or time of day or what? And why do you think certain calls can elicit gobbles when others won't?
Well, obviously, the owl hooter, if you've watched my videos, you see me use that all the time. That's my number one call because it has the range. And what I mean by that, it has some of the soft noises, the typical 8-note, who cooks for you, who cooks for y'all. And then the more abrupt or louder or higher pitch noise of that caterwauling. So it kind of covers the gamut of sounds that can help induce a turkey to the shock gobble. And it's a common animal. So the the wildlife's aware of what it is. You hear it all the time, barred owls in most parts of the country, anywhere where I hunt anyway. The coyote howl is my next locator call. That's kind of a last resort a lot of times if they're not gobbling readily to the owl hooter. I've had them gobble to coyote howls and not to an owl hooter, and I've had them gobble to owl hooters and not coyote howlers. And so it goes both ways, but I've tried all the other stuff. I've tried goose calls. I had one gobble one time before and to that, and then I haven't had much luck with it, so I quit carrying a goose call. Crow calls, I've never had much luck with those. I've had a few gobble at crow calls, but I think crows, because they talk so much throughout the day, I mean, it's just nonstop. You can hear a crow at any point. I think the turkeys become numb to it, and it doesn't, unless that crow is in the tree above them. I think the owl is just a better option. They're familiar with the owl, but the owl calls are not something they hear constantly. And like in the middle of the day, you don't hear owl that often. And all of a sudden an owl fires mm-hmm. up. It's been very good for getting turkeys to gobble. And then my third, I guess, thing I use for locating is actual turkey calls. And I'm not mm-hmm. so concerned with the sound that I'm producing or why I'm saying what I'm doing. I'm more or less trying to make a like cutting and loud yelp and high pitch yelping on a glass call, because it sounds like a turkey that gobbler. If he, you know, if he's in the mood, he may gobble to it, but also that high pitch sound or that loud popping of the cutting on a glass call is enough sometimes to give him the shot gobble. And I don't know, I guess just from over the years, I think picking up these things, those seem to be the best at triggering gobblers to gobble.
Yeah. I think there's kind of a difference in the mood of a turkey. If he, I don't know, maybe I'm wrong or I don't know, but it's kind of something I've kind of noticed over the last couple of years. Like if I strike a turkey with a owl call or, you know, just a regular old locator call, whatever it is, or a turkey call, I think there's a difference. And maybe how that turkey's mood is. I think maybe if a turkey responds to a turkey call, I think maybe, would you agree? Maybe he's maybe in a little bit more mood to work or communicate or work or whatever. Versus if you just got a shot gobble out of him. Like, do you think he's responding more to the turkey call and that he's wanting to attract that hen, or is it just another shot gobble, do you think, from a turkey call?
I actually like turkeys that gobble readily to an owl hooter. If he gobbles as soon as I start to make a note or two, that gobbler is hot. And that's telling me any sound is triggering him to gobble. He's just so worked up and horny or whatever. Because you can run a turkey call and get any turkey to gobble just about, you know, no matter the intensity of their mood. I'm trying to think which one it was. I was just editing recently where I tried to get the bird to gobble. And as soon as I made like, whoo, whoo, I got that first note. He's cutting me off. And I'm like, yeah, that bird is ready. I mean, and so I can imagine those are the birds you sit down. You don't make another sound until you're ready to shoot him. You get your gun up and then you make a turkey mm-hmm. sound and he comes marching right in. So I would much rather have a bird that's gobbling to locator sounds than hen sounds. So it usually tells me they're more ready. They're readier.
I got you. Maybe I've just had more luck like with turkey calls, because if I strike him with whatever, mouth call, slate call, or whatever, and he gobbles, I'm at the ready, I guess, and I can cut him back off, you know, with a hen mm-hmm. call or whatever, and try to get him, you know, even more worked up. Maybe that's where that I've kind of noticed that. Maybe it's my fault and not the turkey's fault that he's getting a little bit more worked up. You said you carried a goose call or you used to carry a goose call. Have there been any other odd locator calls that you've used or you've seen other people use over the years that actually worked?
I wouldn't say there's any that I've done them all. You know, growing up, you know, I was a sucker for trying new things. You know, I had that dog whistle that Mad Calls put out years ago. You know, I fell for that. I had a pileated woodpecker call. You know, and The thing is, you know, I'm back to being a minimalist. The less that I can carry, the better. And I've gotten, I guess, from playing around with a mouth call so much, I can do different sounds with it. I can do a pretty good natural voice crow call, so I don't even carry a crow call because of that. And I've played around doing crow calls on a mouth call. I can do just high-pitched shrills on a mouth call. I can do red-tailed hawks or red-shoulder hawks on a mouth call. A turkey mouth call, you know, I can do loons. I can do about anything. And I can do I've played around with doing pileated woodpecker. I've used an air horn. That's odd, but I didn't carry it in the woods with me. I had it like in my truck and I just like out into the across the thing. And I've gotten turkeys gobbled at that. But, I typically try to stick to natural sounds. I don't know why, but mentally, I want to be a part of the woods and I want to sound like an animal in the woods. And that's, I'm all about realism also. I know people love to natural voice owl hoot, but right away I can tell that's a person hooting. And I'm sure people can tell that I'm running an owl call, but I like to think that it sounds a little more realistic and it's going to fool the animals into thinking that there's no hunter over there. It's just a real animal, you know?
Right. Right. One of the things I picked up from you sometime in the last couple of years was, and I never really thought about it, was how to kind of pinpoint a gobbler after you locate him with turkey call or owl call or whatever, but just you strike a turkey. And I think you were doing this more so in the evenings when you were trying to roost a bird or trying to figure out where to go in the morning to set up on a bird. And you would either, like, you might strike this turkey from the road or whatever, you get a position, maybe throw a pin or some kind of direction on where you heard that gobble from. And then you'd go, I don't know, however many hundred yards down the road or some whatever distance down the road and hopefully strike that bird again and throw another line or another pin in that direction. And you could, that made it a lot easier to pinpoint where that turkey was. But I just, that's something that I've always had a hard time just pinpointing where a turkey was just from the one location I was at, but it made a lot of sense to triangulate your position and figure out more where that turkey was. And I don't know. I just wanted to make that comment that was something that I learned in the last couple of years. That's
helped me tremendously when triangulating turkeys, being able to go in there, you know, and you got to trust yourself, trust the process that when you drop a pin where you triangulated him, that's where he is. And then like I would measure, you know, 75 yards from him and drop a pin where I wanted to be in the morning. And so that's where I made it an effort to get to that spot and sit down. And I wasn't always right. I mean, the last year did I air that video yet? No, I didn't. That video is going to be the first one. It comes out. On my leftover videos, February 4th, it's going to show us triangulating a gobbler. And I have my buddy Clay DeBose with me. and so he talked me out of where I thought the bird was. He's like, oh, I think it's up a little higher on the ridge. And so instead of trusting my process, I let his hearing convince me otherwise. And we ended up 80 yards on the wrong side of that bird. So if Clay, you're listening to this, it's your fault. You're going to have instances like that. I've had it when I'm hunting by myself where I've screwed up and I wasn't in the right spot, but I've had instances where I was perfect. What I have started doing though, because I want to be even more accurate, is I've started carrying a compass around with me so that when, you know, the compass, you know, Onyx has a built-in compass feature. But it's only as good as your phone's GPS and the sensors in your phone. It can be off by quite a bit a lot of times. So what I do typically is if I get a bird to gobble, I will set I'll have my compass sitting there and I'll get like degrees from me. He's 10 degrees north, you know, from my location. And I know that that magnetic north is not the same as a compass north or whatever it is on your
true north or something. Yeah.
Yeah. True north versus magnetic north. Your compass is doing magnetic north. But there's an app that I have on my phone that gets rid of that angle of declination or whatever it's called. And so you can compensate mm-hmm. for that. And so then I will get the, I will drop a pin where I was standing and a pin where I hear the bird gobble, and I will make a note on the pin. I'll say 10 degrees from this location, north, whatever. Then I'll move down the road, or I'll walk mm-hmm. 200 yards to the woods, and I'll get them to gobble again. And I will measure with the compass, and it'll say, you know, 40 something degrees from this location. And I'll write that in my notes, and I'll drop a pin still where I think he's at. But when I get to my truck that evening, you know, I'll usually sit there and eat my dinner, charging batteries, and I'm looking at my map. Now I'm moving the compass on Onyx until it matches up 10 degrees with my, you know, or whatever my figure is with my angle of declination. And I will have that gobbler pinned to a Zach tree, you know, pretty close to it. And I'm getting, it's getting scary accurate, and to the point that I almost feel like it's cheating, you know, that I can know exactly where he's sleeping, and I can slip in there in the dark. And so I told my buddy Joel that hunts with me quite a bit. I said, I'm almost to the point of giving up on roosting gobblers just because I feel like I've got so much of an advantage that it's almost not fun anymore. I'm thinking about just going to the, I'm serious. I'm considering, you know, except for those mornings when I'm desperate, I've gone 3 days without killing one. Then I'm like, I'm just going to roost one. But, I've actually thought about just not even roosting and going out there the next morning and just hunting just so I can make it more of a challenge again, because those roost and roast hunts have become somewhat easier for me. And it's starting to take away the challenge.
I agree. It's gotten exhausting. You know, you just wake up, punch those tags, and you're trying to figure out. I'm sitting here like, my friend, you said that, and it struck me so, I had my mic muted because I got a bit of a cough today. And I'm glad I did, because you said that, and I was laughing and coughing. But I've also ordered a compass now, because I've got a couple of bowls that I hunt around here and where there's an elevation change and the birds are kind of on my level, and I can ride my e-bike around that bowl with the last 30 minutes of like barely legal light. And now I'm going to start doing that exact same thing, because those jokers, it feels like they can throw their voice really well. But with what you're talking about, that's kind of a brilliant move. I'm jonesing. This might be a lot of fun. Hopefully I get tired of killing roosted birds. Shane, I want to touch on something. You talked about the evolution of your locator calls. I've never had a turkey, just for the record, respond to a crow call. I've got buddies who live and die by them that live up in Tennessee and Kentucky. I've never had one respond down here. But I'm curious, how have your turkey tactics when approaching birds or setups, has any of that changed recently? I mean, you tinkered with your guns. It feels like you kind of just gave a bit of a nod to what kind of bird you approach there, from roosted versus not. But I'm curious, do you approach birds any more or less aggressively? Do you do anything differently, or do you just kind of have a playbook that just works for you and you run with it?
I mean, I think there's kind of a book in my head that I can pull from just from years of experience. And I don't really have to think about my next move a lot of times, but I will say that I'm getting more and more aggressive as the last 10 years, you know, 5 to 10 years for sure. And in the last 5 years or less, even more so, I've seen a lot more success the more aggressive I get in my decision-making. Like, for instance, there's a turkey gobbling, and I set up over here, and he starts kind of, you know, working to one side of me, but he's with hens. You know, my traditional way would be just to sit tight and hopefully, you know, they would work back in my direction. Nowadays, you know, in this particular hunt I'm thinking of, I didn't waste any time. I was there for a few minutes. As soon as I saw that they were angling off, I did a big loop, and I went 500 yards on the other side of him and parked. I went to my truck, and then I made a trek through the woods, 200 or 300 yards. I dropped a pin where I thought he was last. That's the other thing. You got to trust yourself, your process, everything. You start second guessing everything, and then it's not going to work out. But you're going to bump birds trusting yourself a lot of times too. But so for in this instance, I dropped a pin where I thought he was at, and he's moving at this pace where I thought he was going to end up at by the time I got to where I wanted to be. And I dropped a pin where I wanted to be. And I wanted to be 150, 200 yards out in front of him. But because I had to go drive around to get to another spot to on the other side of this block of public and come in, you know, I had to go 200 or 300 yards to the woods. I just trusted that. And when I got to my location and I made my first call, he gobbled, or a hen yelped, and then he gobbled, and they were right where I thought they would be. And that's the kind of, you know, that's, I guess you'd call that aggressive, but you've got to be willing to take chances is what I guess I'm getting at. I'm willing to take more chances, and I'm willing to, in the past, I did not want to move because I didn't want to lose tabs on that bird. You know, I wanted to stay with them, mm-hmm. but it didn't help me. I was always chasing them instead of being where they were going. And so like in this instance, I took a chance and I say, they're here. I want to be here. I went there. I ended up, you know, it worked out for me. And I was able, because I was in front of them, I called, and the hens were the first to show up, and then the gobbler showed up a little bit later. But those are the things I'm willing to do more often now, take chances, take gambles. There was a hunt last spring, again, where I was set up on the bird, and I was being a little conservative at first. And I finally said, you know what, I'm not going to get this bird if I'm just being conservative. And so I started crawling. I dropped a pin where he was at, dropped a pin where I wanted to be at. And I wasn't crawling on him. I was crawling just because the woods were somewhat open, where standing up, moving could have potentially busted me, mm-hmm. got me busted. He could see 200 yards through the woods. I put a tree in between me and where he last gobbled, you know, and I would crawl on my hands and knees to that tree. And then I'd sit there for a little bit, hoping, listening. I was listening the whole time I'm crawling. I'm stopping and pausing. But I ended up getting, believe it or not, within 30 yards of that gobbler and his hens. And they didn't see me, and I unfortunately, wow. I didn't see them either. I could hear him drumming. And I was trying to make one more move to get to another tree so I could see. It was like some brush, so I could see beyond it. And as I made my last, like, movement, I looked up. You know, I looked up from my hand where I was placing my hand or moving a stick, and there was a hen, and she bolted. And the gobbler was, like, right there, and he took off with him. And so, you know, that cost me. But, you know, taking those chances, just had I not made that last step or made that mistake, I would have been 30 yards from the gobbler and killed him. You know, potentially. And so that's mm-hmm. taking chances, being more aggressive, is what's really helped me lately.
I think Sorry, that a lot of people just don't read. No, that's, you know, I just think a lot of people don't realize how much you can get away with if a turkey can't see you. And I've mm-hmm. said it, I don't know how many times, you know, so long as you're not making like human noise, you know, talking, coughing, you know, beating, you know, clanking some pieces of metal together, the gun or just whatever. Like, you can get away with a lot so long as that turkey don't see you. And, you know, I've used that to my advantage, you know, getting as close as I can to roosted birds. You know, if they were just over, you know, the edge of a ridge or something like that, I mean, I have a hard time staying quiet in the woods anyway, I guess because I'm clumsy and I'm an idiot and I just sound like drunk elephants marching through the leaves. But I mean, I pat myself on the back for not bumping turkeys just from walking through the leaves. Like, you know, they sit up there in the dark all night and they hear, yeah, good job, Joey. But they hear all kinds of stuff all night long, you know, that they can't see. And so I think, I don't know that they, you know, really put two and two together, you know, when it's still dark outside and there's rustling in the leaves. Like, they can't really know that much that it's a hunter coming through the leaves and not a deer or an armadillo. Or
I don't think they figure that out either.
Yeah. And then the same thing, like when Parker and Jacob and I went up to Montana this year, that last bird that we killed on that trip, it was my turn on the gun. And from Parker and Jacob's viewpoint, they were kind of up. They were up a little bit behind like this big rock and they were filming me creeping up on this turkey. And from their viewpoint, it was just an open field, like with not even that tall of grass, like very little tall grass. From their viewpoint, it just looked like I was creeping up on this turkey through the field with nothing in between us. But there mm-hmm. was just enough of a rise or a knob in that field between me and that turkey that I was able to crawl. I don't know. I was able to crawl within 40 yards of this gobbler out in the wide open field in Montana. And, you know, the wind helped too, at least, you know, mask any kind of, you know, grass or whatever that I was crawling through. But so long as that bird didn't see me, you know, I mean, I was just crawling. And if he moved, I think there were a couple of little pine trees, you know, kind of scattered out here and there. If he moved and got behind a tree, you know, I would kind of scoot to the side or just do whatever. But so long as I kept his head, kept something between me and his head, I was comfortable in crawling on that turkey. And so I think people can get more aggressive than they think they can when it comes to turkeys, just so long as they don't see you. Just, I mean, do what you can.
That's right. I agree.
It's funny, when I first started hunting, a lot of the books I read said you can't beat a turkey's eyes, and it's true. But I think what Joey, one of the things I saw last year was there were a couple birds I crawled up on, and I was making all kinds of ruckus that I probably in the moment didn't think I was making. But like in hindsight, when I go back and I watch the video, I'm like, well, you were really, really loud. I ended up crawling within 30 yards because of like a little slight ridge. It was that last weekend. I don't remember. Were you in the Patreon group that last weekend that guy blew my hunt up? And I crawled within like 30 yards of that drumming turkey. Okay. Anyways, I just told the story. So there it is. But I crawled up over this ridge just ever so slowly. And every time his fan would face away from me, I would crawl a little bit further and keep like a tree like in between me and him. And I got within 30, 35 yards of him. And another hunter came walking down the swamp hearing that gobbler just fire off. And ended up spooking him. But it was at that point in time, like, I close the distance from about 100 to about 30 using topography. And when I look back at that footage, how loud I was, I don't know if he just thought I was feeding hens. I don't know if he just didn't care in that moment. But I've snuck up on a couple birds, doing something similar to that last year. And it feels like if they can't see it, they almost don't care, for a lack of better words. It's almost a disregard. And
I don't think turkeys, react to sound as much as, say, like deer do. You know, like a turkey, if they don't see you, you can be as loud as you want to be, and they may have their head up alert waiting for whatever it is to come into view. They're not going to run off, whereas a deer in the same situation, they'll take off long before you get in sight, because they seem to be able to figure out that that sounds a person and not, or, you know, just like you busting through the brush in like a cattail marsh, like where I hunt for deer. They instantly know I'm not a deer come through that marsh, and they take off. Whereas, you know, a turkey, I've had, like you said, I had, was it last year, I believe, or year before last, I had some birds came in. I didn't get a shot on them, and they worked back down the ridge. And so I wanted to circle and get in front of them. So I dropped on the other side of the ridge and worked my way down to the end of the ridge. And I kind of popped up, and I was just going to sit down right there at the tip of the ridge, just on one, right over the, like the lip of it. And as I'm sitting there, I'm setting up my camera, my tripod to film me run a pot call, right? Kind of set it up to be my cameraman. And I could hear something rustling in the leaves, and I thought it was a squirrel just on the other side of the lip. And I kicked myself still to this day for not thinking about it and checking it out. But I'd made a lot of noise in the leaves myself, and so I didn't think anything about it. I guess that was part of the reason I thought it was a squirrel and not a turkey. But anyway, I stepped about 5 feet in front of the camera to run the pot call, and that 5 feet stepping out, I gained about a foot of elevation. And when I did, I saw like 6 turkey heads pop up. They were sitting there scratching the leaves, feeding just, you know, 20 yards from me. And I got that close. And I guess maybe they thought I was just another turkey walking through the leaves or what, but it wasn't until they saw me that they got out of there. Had that been a deer would have heard me walking. They would have been gone.
I think that's one of the things I love about turkey hunting is it feels, gosh, I can't put it into words. I thought I had it there for just a second. It feels less stress-based in the moment. There are moments of stress, but it's like I don't have to be like on my P's and Q's from the time I step out of the truck to the time I, you know, I draw back on a deer. It feels like the margin for error for just, you know, existing is smaller. I don't know if that makes any sense at all now that I've said that out loud, but I'm going to run with it.
No, it makes sense to me just because, like we said, I mean, they just don't respond to sound that much. And until you know they can see your position, then there's not that much stress, you know, so long as you're not, you know, like we said, you're not making human noise. You're not making unnatural noises. You're just stomping through the leaves or you're making turkey calls or whatever.
But that goes back to like deer and turkey.
Consider that much of a threat.
But going back to deer and turkeys, like a deer will respond to that sound where a turkey just waits to see what it is. On the flip side, a turkey sees you and they're gone, and a deer will look at you and kind of bob his head and try to figure out what it's seeing.
Mm-hmm.
So I think each has their advantages and disadvantages. But
I heard a guy one time describe it as a turkey sees something move and it says hunter with an exclamation point, like hunter. And a deer goes, hunter? Like question, like you've got that, like that moment there, you know? And I was like, that's really smart. I've never heard of it said that way before. And then he said that. I was like, that's really great. That might have been Clay. I'll give him credit for that one. I think that might have been Clay.
Saying that says that a deer will think every hunter is a stump and a turkey will think every stump is a hunter.
Yeah, I bet that's what Clay was actually saying, and he just paraphrased it to sound really wise. Well, Shane,
there's one more saying that I think that I thought I saw or heard or something one day that says if you fart in the woods, a bear will smell it, a deer will hear it, and a turkey can see it.
I've never heard that before, Joey. That's amazing.
Yeah, that's a good one.
But it's all true, I think.
All those are good ones. I like the exclamation and the question mark one too. I gotta need to make a meme about that.
Yeah, there you go. There you tag Soko Hunt.
Yeah. we'll do. Yeah, Parker to make it.
I have got
he's good at that.
Yeah.
It was shame on him for not being here because he would have really ran with that in the moment, you know?
Yeah.
He made a t-shirt out of it.
Yeah.
You guys going to be at Nashville? all you guys going to be at Nashville? You going to be there, Walter?
Should be, barring any kind of child sickness or emergency. I didn't get to go last year because of my son's surgery, but I am really looking forward to going this year, and I'm hoping nobody pops off sick or something crazy.
Mm-hmm.
So. Walter, you're
not going
to
be there, but Parker's going to be there.
No, Parker's not going to be there either. So we had to move our Patreon deer hunt that we host every year to the last weekend of January. And so that kind of killed the PTO request with the wives. But I think we are on the wait list to have a booth problem there.
You get my age, you don't have those issues.
Yeah.
I live an hour away too, so if I lived any further away, I'd probably be in that same camp. I'd have to put in my leave well in advance.
I'm almost 15 hours to get a kitchen pass. She's not happy.
Elena
She's
wants
not
to
going this
family
year,
trip
though.
Out That's of it. Sure. All right, gentlemen, I'm going to put a pin in this. I've got other things I've got to do. I could sit here for a couple more hours and talk. Shane, at some point, I'd love to share turkey camp with you. We need to, like, you know, when you start really doing your southern tours again, we should really try and find a way to link up, because I'd love to just sit in the woods and listen to you talk to a turkey, man. Every time I sit quietly without a gun and just listen to a turkey hunter who knows what he's doing, it's just like I wish I had a notepad where I could just take notes, because anybody who's listening right now, if you're new to turkey hunting or you're struggling with turkey hunting, I cannot stress enough, find somebody to go with who knows what they're doing, and then just sit quietly and don't ask questions and just watch what they do, because they'll put on a clinic right in front of you for free. It's awesome.
Yeah. If I had to give one bit of advice, and I know everyone says patience, 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 and I never really understood that because I thought it really didn't mean much to just to be patient and sit there and wait for something. But patience in the right context is a big part of success in the turkey woods. You know, take your time, listen to what's going on, listen to everything out there. That's one thing that's helped me a lot lately is just, you know, be more observant and quiet and listening to your surroundings while you're out there. That's part of the patience thing. You got to be patient and take that all in. I think if people can master that part of it, they don't need to sit there and watch me hunt. They can figure it out on their own pretty quickly.
That's awesome, man. Well, I appreciate you pulling time out your evening and joining us. And we'd love to have you on anytime you want to talk. Well, heck, we need to have you on to talk deer hunting, because I don't think I've ever had you on to talk about that. And you go on some hella fun adventures. I enjoy everything you put out, man. I really appreciate you.
Yeah, I appreciate that. I don't know if anybody wants to hear me talk about deer too much. I'm not an expert at that. I'm just a regular deer hunter. I wouldn't say I'm an expert at turkey hunting either. Okay.
All right, guys, until next time, get outside, enjoy the great outdoors, get your turkey quotas permits in. If you haven't already, dust off the calls, get ready. It will be here sooner than you realize. You're going to wake up one day and it's going to be time to get after it. So until next time, get outside and enjoy the great outdoors.